do yourself a favor and show this to as many people as you possibly can, because this is going to be the world that we'll be living in. I'll tell you, it's been a real awesome experience for me, like being here in Brazil and the different places that I've taken the HTC Vive. A lot of the time, you know, being able to show it to somebody and give them that experience and see like that click happen where they're like, whoa, oh my God, my whole life just changed. It's a cool thing to witness.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome back. This is part two of my very special episode, Mixed Reality and the Future of Design, with my friend and very special guest, Austin Knight. I hope you enjoyed part one. If you hadn't listened yet, then there's going to be a link in the show notes. Check it out. You just get some context. Also, I want to let you know we're going to pick up where we left off. We're going to start talking about education, design patterns, my favorite, empathy. Austin also covers companies to watch and how we can get started. So buckle up for safety and please enjoy part two of this very special episode. Education, I think, is going to be a big part of VR. In fact, it already is in some ways. There's a lot of focus and a lot of concentration. Can you talk about some of the benefits that it will have and impacts it will have on education?
Yep. Education is another one of my favorite use cases. And this is one that if you want people to understand how compelling this stuff is, usually starting with education is the best way to go, because everybody loves education. Everyone wants to improve it. They want to make it more universal. And it's very easy to imagine how VR can revolutionize education. There's an excellent TED Talk from a company called Labster. And what they're doing is they're bringing virtual science labs to communities that don't have the resources to build a real lab. So, you know, you think of like most of the United States, probably Jason, where you went to high school, definitely where I went to high school, we had a very standard science lab that we were able to use. And it was donated, you know, by members of the community and government assistance and everything like that. So you and I probably did the same exact experiments in our labs in high school. And our labs probably looked the same. You know, everybody loves that sort of shower thing with that triangular handle that you can pull down and flood the entire lab. You've got those black top tables and the beakers and all that stuff. It's a typical science lab. And what we find is that science labs in high schools that, you know, all around the world that can afford a science lab, they mostly look and function the same, and almost all of the same experiments are performed, and they all have the same results. The point is to just take the student through that process and familiarize them with that. Well, there are a lot of communities here, you know, in Latin America, in Africa, in parts of Asia, Eastern Europe, everywhere, even in parts of the United States, that cannot afford those labs. And so students end up just having to go based off of what they see in a book or something that a teacher is telling them, or perhaps they don't even have access to science education at all. And what Labster has done is they said, wait a second, all of this stuff is very predictable. The labs are designed the same, the experiments are the same, the results are the same. We can create a virtual experience that will allow students to enter these labs without requiring the schools to take all of that investment and build the lab itself. So they've created virtual science labs for high schools that will be provided to underserved communities, so that if you don't have a lab, you can still do all of the lab experiments that you would do in a typical high school lab, but in VR. And the results that they found when they started to do this were pretty compelling. They found that this virtual lab was actually, not only were they able to supply a lab to an underserved community that would have otherwise not have access to this, so you can already imagine how much better that is than nothing. But they actually realized that the application of this lab, this virtual lab, would also be really effective in communities that already have a lab. Like, it's because it's better than a real lab. So
yeah, imagine the resource savings.
Yeah, the resource savings, but also virtual reality, this sort of taking it back to what I was talking about, how you can manipulate your environment and the experience in ways that are not possible in the real physical world, your learning opportunities open up even more. So not only are you performing the experiment, but Labster, you know, will allow you to physically, you know, you take your hand and you put it on a beaker. And you're holding a real beaker. It actually has a motion tracker in the beaker.
And then
you pour that into another beaker or whatever it is that you're using.
Yeah.
And the reaction happens, and you can see that all happening. And then Labster will say, hey, do you want to see from a microscopic view what chemical reaction is actually happening? And you can say yes. And then it zooms you into it. And now you're in the world. You're inside of that the liquid that you just poured together, and you're seeing the chemical reaction happening, and it's explaining it to you, and it's happening in a way that would have never been possible in real life.
Look out, Heisenberg.
Yeah, man.
Oh my gosh.
Oh God.
Oh no. What have I done?
So Labster's testing actually found that the virtual lab was 76% more effective than traditional teaching methods in a real lab. So again, underserved communities and actually communities that already have a lab can benefit from this. And the students, they would go into this lab for 2 hours inside of VR, and they'd come out and they'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe I just spent 2 hours in there. And then they're retention of what they had learned was around 76% higher than the students that just dealt with a real lab, a traditional lab. And then, and this is where I get really excited, is they found that when they paired the teacher with the virtual lab, it was actually 101% more effective.
Oh my goodness.
So this is to say, we're not going to be replacing teachers or real life labs with VR labs, but rather we're finding that when you have the real lab, the real teacher, and the VR to enhance it, it is 101% more effective than just having the teacher in the real lab. So this kind of brings up this realization that VR is not going to replace, but augment what we're already doing. And I really like this because a lot of people are, you know, saying, especially AR and machine learning, it's going to take our jobs, or, I'm not going to be able to design for this stuff, or, you know, I can see how a teacher may feel threatened by something like Labster. But what we find is actually it's just going to make you better at your job.
Oh, wow. That is very fascinating information, Austin. I was thinking too about also the retention factor. Like, that makes a lot of sense. It's a, like you said, it's a complement. It's not a replacement. It is a complement to what is already in existence. And in fact, it sounds like a very effective one. But I also thought about, you know, the whole lab environment. And I thought another possible use case, just because I'm a weirdie, and I thought about like people who dissect animals, you know, our animal loving friends, they're going to love that. They're going to probably be able to dissect an animal without actually getting their hands dirty.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting.
It goes on and on, right?
Man, the possibilities are limitless, it seems.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about home improvement, okay? Are you a homeowner, Austin, or have you ever been?
I'm not. I'm at a point in my life where I don't really want to be, but of course, you know, typical tech industry stuff, you spend all of your money on rent and travel and gadgets. So I couldn't afford one even if I wanted to.
All right. Well, no, you know, I just became one, and it hasn't been very long. I mean, it's been about 4 years, 4+ years, but rented before that. So anything that went wrong, all I had to do was pick up the phone and call the landlord, and hopefully that person was kind enough to address it. So I never had to do anything on my own. But once you own a home, you are going to be doing a lot more. You're going to be learning a lot more how to fix stuff. Otherwise, you're just going to be broke. You're always, perpetually, because it costs a lot to hire somebody to do little things around the house. So all that to say, in my research for our conversation, Austin, I found something really fascinating, and it's something about Lowe's. I don't know. Maybe you posted this. I can't remember, but something about how Lowe's is actually using virtual reality for home improvement training, and it's what they're finding is they're actually the users of this. They're doing a trial run. The users are actually having a 36% better recall of how to actually complete a home improvement project when compared to people who simply watched a YouTube, and that's exciting to me because I've watched a lot of YouTube videos, and some of these people are so experienced they make it look so easy, and it's just not as easy as you think, or maybe there's just an angle that's missing, right? Like, and when you're doing a home, when you're trying to repair a sink or like a pipe or something, like that's a pretty big deal. You want to make sure you can see everything that you're doing. So that was fascinating to me, for sure. And then I thought about travel, and I know we talked a little bit about this, and I completely agree with you and your fiance's perspective of please, no matter where you can go with VR, please don't let it take the place of the real thing, because there's nothing quite like actually physically being in a space and breathing the air and eating the food and talking face to face with the people. And so totally agree with that. But one thing that's interesting, and as you touched on, like underserved communities and such who just don't have the means to, especially with large families like me. Like, I mean, dude, I got so many kids. I got a soccer team, you know, like I can't afford to get all my kids on an airplane to go to Israel or to go to Europe, let alone even go to Florida to visit my family. So I think one of the benefits of this is going to be, especially educationally, if somebody's studying, like, for example, they're doing a report on the Colosseum, imagine being able to actually just feel like you're standing in the middle of it without actually even leaving your living room. That's fascinating to me, and learning all this stuff that you're actually, when we use all of our senses, I think we just learn more. We retain more, as we've already discussed with some statistics. And so I think that's fascinating to me as well, Austin.
Yeah, I have to completely agree. And I think that we'll find that there's a complementary relationship between travel use cases for VR and actual travel. We know 15%, right around 15% of the U.S. population has a passport, which is much lower than other westernized nations. And it's actually lower than even some third world countries. So there is, it's an interesting thing with the United States, you know, how we have a lot that we can do at home. You know, it's a huge country, very diverse country. Yeah. But there also isn't a total culture of travel there in the same way that there is in Europe or in South America. And I like to think that perhaps a little bit more exposure to the possibilities for travel through VR could give a little bit more people the travel bug and can convince us to get outside of our environment and our bubbles if we have the means. If you don't have the means, then of course, yes, this is your option and it's incredible. But I know that as somebody, you know, that grew up, I grew up in Kentucky. Wasn't a lot of traveling happening. I actually didn't get my passport until like 2 years ago. And, you know, now I travel like 300,000 kilometers a year. So I went from like zero to 110. I didn't really realize what was out there, you know, in both a landscape and a world sense and a cultural sense, but also in a knowledge sense, I guess, you know, like, I didn't realize how beautiful the world was and what had been built or what had been naturally formed and the amazing sights that I could see. But I also didn't understand other people in the world and their perspectives and everything like that. And so I would hope that, travel, you know, could be improved as a result of the use of VR to sort of get a taste. It's like, you know, put your feet in the water, take that trip to the Roman Colosseum in VR, and man, it'll make you want to go. You can already kind of do it with Google Earth VR. You know, you can stand in the middle of the Colosseum. You can come to my apartment here in Rio. Last time I was in the United States, I picked up the HTC Vive and I set it up at my mom's house and I took her to my apartment and she stood at the foot of this building that I'm sitting in right now. So it is, I agree with you. And I also think that, if you think about, okay, so let's say that we combine a little bit of education and travel in VR, and we start to see that journalism is a pretty big opportunity here as well. And so outlets like the Washington Post, for example, they have an entire web VR room where they that's like online. You can access it again through your computer or a headset or your smartphone, and they'll do everything from transporting their viewers to Syria to the surface of Mars to the presidential inauguration. And the reason that I like this is because, especially in this age of fake news where nobody trusts the New York Times or CNN or Fox News or even the Washington Post, because they editorialize so many things and they all have such strong agendas and biases, VR has the ability to put the user in that actual experience without any editorialization. Nobody's going to be writing their version of the article or chopping up their video in a certain way. They're going to set that 360 camera, or perhaps in the future that volumetric VR device, in the middle of the experience, and you'll be able to interpret it the way that you want, that raw experience, which is, that's been, to me, that's the thing that has changed my life more than anything by traveling, is that what I know and what I've learned is not editorialized in any way. I mean, I didn't graduate college. I didn't get a college degree. I was never somebody that was, would get the morning paper or something like that. So there was always like this sort of thirst within me, like, how can I get information not through a professor, not through a media outlet, but through, something that is much more raw and something that I can trust a lot more. And the way that I found to do that is to travel and to, have those experiences come to me through conversations that I have with people or things that I physically witness, from the poorest of the poorer situations to, places that are extremely economically privileged and everything in between and politically and all of that stuff. And there's no real way to do that right now except for traveling. Like the only way that you can really get that raw experience is to travel. And maybe there's glimpses that you can get of it on the internet or through a paper or something, but it's not real. And I think that VR or mixed reality even could be a step towards that, towards bringing those completely raw and non-editorialized experiences to individuals that can't take the time or the money, or perhaps their health limits them, or they just don't want to travel. It's not going to have to go through a professor that has a very specific political leaning or, a news organization that's backed by a company that has stakes in whatever it is that they're talking about. It can come through on its own.
That's so fascinating. And I appreciate you mentioning the accessibility factor too. Like that's another really important area, is there's a lot of folks who are disabled and just don't have the opportunity. They don't have the opportunity or means or physical ability to actually go and experience another culture, another environment. And I think that's another huge benefit. And that's fascinating about the journalism aspect to this. I think that's definitely going to hopefully it will bring more of our journalism into an area of truth and give people a lot more possibilities in that way. But you touched on the empathy factor as well. You kind of touched on that. And I know, and I'll be honest with you, Austin, this has probably been the biggest sort of mind and game changer for me when I started kind of to try to overlook some of my initial bias that I kind of discussed earlier. Empathy, the ability to actually almost literally stand in somebody else's shoes, which is really the definition of empathy. And Chris Milk has done a lot of work on this, and his TED Talks are very popular, and we'll be sure to link to those in the show notes as well. But he did a talk called How VR Can Create the Ultimate Empathy Machine. And he's a filmmaker, basically. He's a filmmaker, and then he started doing music videos. But then he discovered this thing called VR, and he was kind of an early arriver in using this in filmmaking. So, and what he's done just to help breed empathy is he touched on a project that he calls Clouds Over Cedra, and it's about a 12-year-old. It's basically, it's a documentary, a short documentary about the life of a 12-year-old Syrian refugee, and her name is Cedra. But basically, when you put on those goggles and you sit there, you're like in the room with her. And you look down, you're sitting in the same ground that she's sitting on, the same dusty, dirty ground. And you feel what she feels in a way. You feel her humanity in a far deeper way. And you empathize with her in a much deeper way, too. So I thought that was really fascinating, case for empathy with VR. That's just something we can only use our imaginations otherwise. And it's just a great way to open that door into what other people experience. And also, in addition to that, there's something that I think another TED talk, I can't remember his name right now, but he touched on something, a project called The Machine to Be Another. And basically they're using VR to quite literally put you in somebody else's shoes. They basically do some sort of generation. I don't know how they do it, but it's some sort of scan where the person that you're trying to become, like, you're basically looking at who they are and their body, I think this could help with like racial discrimination and prejudice, and you know, if someone could actually see and feel what other people, what another person's life is like.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I also think that in a different way, we can already see this happening through applications like Altspace VR that I was talking about earlier, where you choose how you look. And, you know, if you want to be a person with no race or gender, I don't know, maybe if you want to be an alien or a paper bag, you can do that, you know, and it,
somebody's
it
writing this down
to
right now,
break down a lot of those barriers and prejudices that we have built up from a very young age.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually from a designer's perspective, you know, this is a huge, huge breakthrough for us. When I was speaking in South Africa, one of the speakers that was also at the conference was Nancy Duyong, who works at Uber now, but prior to that, she was at Google, and she's fully focused on inclusive design. And it's amazing how many opportunities we can find in existing designs to apply empathy in like ways that should be very obvious to us, but we would just never think of if we didn't have the opportunity to live a day in somebody else's shoes. For example, Nancy actually consulted with the team at Facebook Oculus on the design of their VR headset because it didn't fit people with an Asian facial structure. The headset didn't work for them. And we see in like Shenzhen, China, especially, there are hundreds of different headset designs that are being experimented with right now. That fixed that problem. But the Oculus Rift, whether it hadn't been, what we had concluded was kind of that it hadn't been tested on those subjects before. So, you know, you see things like that, or there's that like viral video, with the faucet, the automatic faucet that would only turn on if a white person put their hand under it. If you had like darker skin, it didn't sense your hand. And so I think that there are a lot of ways where, you know, if you're a designer and you're not exposed to different cultures or people or places or whatever, VR would hopefully have the ability to afford you that opportunity.
Definitely. So we touched on design patterns a little bit. That was one of your answers to why you're doing this, is to be kind of a part of really establishing some of these design patterns. I mean, everything is so new that there's still so much being established in how to use these technologies. So, we know how important they are, obviously. And we're building systems, not pages anymore, on the web. So what sort of design patterns are you discovering and perhaps even defining in this nascent area?
Yeah, this is like the most exciting part of it. I mean, when I first started building that web VR site and the AR experience that I created, I've got a business card that has an augmented reality experience attached to it. The first thing that really stood out to me was like, I had just opened up a completely new world, and it was totally green, totally new. Uncharted. Yeah. Yes. And the last time I felt like that was like when I was like 11 years old and I discovered HTML and I built my first website, and I was like, oh my God, anybody can put something up on the internet and I can create a fake business and appear like I'm a real adult, you know, and all this crazy stuff. It was like, everything is possible now.
Yes.
And I had never felt that way since, until I started building in mixed reality.
Wow.
And that's because you're now dealing with a 3D space. So there was a great quote that I heard recently that said, designers have always worked with what you could call a box of crayons, right? So we've always had three crayons in that box, red, green, and blue. And mixed reality adds a fourth crayon, and that's depth. So now we can design in 3D spaces, in full environments, with depth added into it. And that really opens up a whole new axis, literally, of opportunities. Hmm. So because it's so new, though, we're still asking really big questions about, like, you know, even the most basic patterns that need to be established. So I recently published a podcast on the UX and Growth podcast with Casey Yee.
Yes.
At Mozilla, who
was a great one.
thank you.
Yeah.
He's an extremely intelligent guy, and he was one of the original creators of web VR. And we've been working together on, like, you know, what are these patterns, and how can we establish them? And like, some of the questions that have been coming out are, you know, what does a cursor look like in VR? Or what does a link look like? How does a user know if an element is interactive? How do user interfaces work in VR? And how is 2D content going to translate into VR? Because, you know, we have all of this whole web, and we're, you know, that's already created in a 2D space, and we're talking about creating a metaverse, which is basically going to be a 3D web, or in the most basic sense of terms, like an environment that is the internet that you can interact with and walk around in. How is the 2D stuff going to function and display in those environments? Does sound have a place in web VR experiences? Classically, sound would be something that you wouldn't relate to a good web experience. Nobody likes having their sound hijacked on the web, and that's sort of a no-no in UX practices or best practices. But sound is actually a fundamental part of immersive experiences and of virtual reality. So how does that work in web VR? What about the user's height? Like, how tall does the user stand in a VR environment? That can have some serious impacts on realism and immersion and how you feel in that environment. And cognitive load, like, how do we best introduce users to VR experiences and show them use cases, onboard them? We find that cognitive load needs to be really, really, really low in these early VR experiences because it's the base cognitive load in a 2D experience or on a, you know, on a laptop or a phone or whatever is very low for us right now, because as humans, you know, have been growing up with these devices for some time, we're already very familiar with the affordances and the patterns and everything that come with them. So you don't have to learn how to use a phone on like the most basic level. But with VR, everybody is going to have to do that. Not only do you have to learn how to use the experience that's being created, but you have to teach the user how to use and how to interpret VR. So it's almost like, imagine, you know, giving a smartphone, the first time that you gave a smartphone or a computer to your grandma. She wasn't born in a world with those devices, so she had to learn how to use the device first. We have to do that with VR for everybody now, because nobody was really born into a world with a metaverse or with mixed reality. Of course, that will soon change. But so cognitive load has become a very big talking point in VR. And we, you know, we think about human cognition in general and spatial recognition and everything like that. But there are also some really strong patterns that we've already established. So the use of reticles, which is a circular cursor that indicates what the user is looking at, that they use this to click on an element or to sustain a gaze, and then the reticle will transform in color and position and size, and that indicates that it's fusing. So that's how a click happens. And fusing itself is actually a pattern that's been established, and that's really like the process of clicking in VR based on a sustained gaze. So, you know, in some cases you have a mouse or a hand input and then you can use that to point and click, but in other cases you just have the headset. Then you look at something with the reticle, it fuses, does an animation, and then it clicks. And you'll see that in Google Cardboard. You'll see that in an HTC Vive. It's an established pattern. We have integrated UIs. So like heads-up displays seem to be the most natural reaction for designers. Is like that the first thing that you want to create in VR is a heads-up display, but it actually doesn't really work. The elements can't be attached to the user as they're moving around. It makes them feel dizzy. Sometimes they feel too close or too far away. Things can get hard to read. So interfaces are actually better if they're integrated into the environment itself. And the best UI is going to curve around the user or be part of an object that's in the 3D environment. So there are a lot of patterns that we're still looking to establish. There are some really interesting, unique patterns that we have established. And I think that's a big part of what's so exciting about mixed reality right now, is that we don't just have an opportunity to be early creators in this environment, but we have an opportunity to define the medium itself.
Exciting stuff, Austin. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around all this, but this already has opened up a lot of neural pathways for me. It's connected a lot of dots for me, like I said. But yeah, I think it's just super exciting, and it's it does, like, especially listening to you talk about it, it feels like you're like Daniel Boone or something, like just kind of like in uncharted territory and just really discovering things and being a part of this. So it's really exciting. And so what about, do you want to talk about like some of the stats associated and maybe some of the things to watch for with companies and such on this?
Yep. So this is a really good indicator. Like whenever you want to know where the tech industry is going, you can start to look at where's VC capital being placed. And if you look at Silicon Valley right now, you'll see that a lot of the money, almost all of the money, is being put into virtual reality, augmented reality, machine learning. Basically, those earlier technologies that I described that are coming together to create mixed reality. So over $500 million has been invested in VR startups in the last quarter alone. It's literally like tons and tons of money is going there.
Wow.
But it's not just startups that are investing in this. Microsoft, for example, they're basically betting their entire company on HoloLens. And as I said earlier, HoloLens would be a great product for you to try if you get the opportunity. I had the opportunity to use one in Dublin, Ireland a couple months ago. There was a guy that has one there. They're a little bit hard to come by, but if you're in a major metro area, basically anywhere in the world, you'll probably be able to find one at a meetup. And this is a real augmented reality device. And Microsoft is they've built a developer platform for it, and they've built the device itself, and the investment is absolutely insane. This is, according to Microsoft, the future of Microsoft. And they're especially focused on like work use cases. So it's not very much of a consumer product right now. It's really more of something that's going to be used to improve work environments. So for example, Siemens is using virtual reality and augmented reality to train their future employees whatever their role is going to be, especially if it's something complicated like working on an oil rig. And then HoloLens will help with like people that are on assembly lines or in dangerous work environments with handling errors and preventing them from happening. It really becomes something that can help revolutionize the way that we work. So Microsoft is a big company to watch in this space. Obviously, Facebook is going to be a huge player. They purchased Oculus a while back, and the headset is not their end game. They're really good at social, and that's such a weirdly general term, but it actually does apply in this case. Like Facebook is going to probably be the social authority in mixed reality. And we haven't really figured that out in VR, but we can see that they're making early investments with Facebook Spaces and AR Studio. And of course, Altspace VR, as I mentioned earlier, is kind of doing some experiments there as well. So I think that's super exciting. Snap, or the parent company of Snapchat, is calling themselves a camera company. And that's not an accident. I wouldn't view them as a camera company right now, but that is aspirational. And that's because if you look at the devices that they're creating, you can kind of start to see that they're heading in the direction of AR type of device. So spectacles, I have a pair of spectacles. It's basically just sunglasses that you wear with a camera on them, and you can press a button and it'll record 10 seconds of whatever you're seeing and upload it to Snapchat. Those are basically like an alpha AR device. That's how I'm thinking of them right now. And I would say that they're the real thing that Snap is trying to accomplish here is that they want to reduce the social stigma around wearing a camera or an IoT device on your face. Because it's weird. Every time I put on the spectacles, I feel awkward, because I know if people recognize the device, they know that there's a camera on my face that's looking at them. This is the same problem that Google Glass had a while back.
Terminator.
And that makes me feel weird. Yeah. you can already see the groundwork being laid to destroy social barriers to these devices, and Snap is investing in that right now.
What are the spectacles like? Are those like glasses, or like more stylish than maybe Google Glass?
They're a little bit more stylish, but I guess like I feel a little bit more comfortable wearing them than I did wearing Google Glass. Uh-huh. But they are still very distinct, and it's intentional. So if you're like, I find that when I'm wearing spectacles here in South America, people don't recognize them. They just think I'm wearing goofy sunglasses, because that's really what they look like, is just a goofy, rounded pair of sunglasses. But in the U.S., people definitely recognize them. In Europe, people definitely recognize them. And they'll walk up to you and they'll be like, oh, man, how'd you get those? Because they're really hard to get still. HubSpot actually gave like everybody at the company a pair of spectacles, but so that's how I got them. I wouldn't have been able to get them on my own. But basically they're just a goofy looking pair of sunglasses, and the reason for that is partially branding, but really more honestly, it's because the designers didn't want to create something that was too discreet, because then it could be perceived from the people that aren't wearing them as you know, like a creepy attempt at disguising a camera. But then you also don't want to create something that's too obvious or too goofy, sort of like the Google Glass, I would argue, because then nobody's going to want to wear it. So you have to actually destroy the social stigma on both sides, on the side of other people being uncomfortable with somebody wearing a camera on their face, and on the side of the individual being uncomfortable with wearing a camera on their face. And I think that that's they created a nice balance in the design of the device. But I have to admit that when I go out and I wear those things, I still bring another pair of sunglasses just in case I get into a situation where I feel awkward, because it happens a lot where somebody will look at you for a little too long and it's like, oh crap, they think I'm recording them or something. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Building up the YouTube subscriber count with,
right.
So what I'm curious, what's the UV protection quotient on these spectacles?
They're not. So as far as I know, they're not polarized, but I do believe that they are UV protectant. You should, you know, here's what I would say is, if you're either very active on Snapchat or if you're very interested in AR and VR and that type of stuff, then get a pair of spectacles. If not, find a friend that has a pair and just ask them to let you play around with them for a couple minutes, and they'll probably want to show them off because they're pretty interesting. But a lot of people end up buying them, and if they're not in one of those two categories that I mentioned earlier, then they'll use them a couple times and then they won't want to use them anymore.
Okay.
So yeah, that's, I would say you've probably, you know, got a friend that has a pair that you could play around with them. And it's cool to see how that, like the form factor of the device is really impressive. It looks like, you know, it's not like you're wearing a computer on your head, even though you are. It mostly looks like a pair of sunglasses, just with a little bit of a goofy design.
So I'm curious, do you wear your sunglasses at night so you can see the light that's right before my eyes? Your eyes.
Yeah, so that's another weird thing, is that they are sunglasses, so you can't really, like, using them indoors or at night is, like, basically out of the question unless you pop out the lenses, okay. Which, a guy that I work with, Ryan Benici, he's a huge, like, Snapchat influencer, and so he wants to use them all the time. So first thing he did, as soon as he got his pair, he just popped the lenses right out of them.
Oh, nice.
And it's so funny because now he's basically walking around with, like, poser glasses. But I guess they do the job.
Getting his pour over with those on.
Exactly. Oh,
that's awesome. That's awesome. Sorry, I was curious about the spectacles. Do continue, please.
Yeah, so the spectacles are cool, fun thing to play around with, but yeah. They're another thing where, in isolation of everything else, they look like a toy, but when you look at the bigger picture and where Snap is taking themselves, you can start to see that they're probably playing around with AR. Of course, a more obvious manifestation of this is the filters and masks and stuff like that that you can put on yourself in the Snapchat app. Yep. That's like, you know, that is a form of augmented reality.
It truly is. It's still fascinating to see that. It's weird, mm-hmm. but fascinating and interesting too. Like, well, somebody put a lot of time developing that technology.
Yeah. Google is another one to watch. They've got some huge investments in Daydream VR, Web VR, Project Tango, which I guess that now they've dropped the project and it's just Tango because it's live on some of their phones. Uh-huh. But that's like their version of AR Kit. So that's augmented reality on an Android device. And it's very, very good. Very good. I have a Tango, my little Android that I bought as a Tango phone, and a really amazing motion tracking and interaction with the environment and everything like that. Mozilla is a company to watch. They, as I mentioned earlier, Casey Yee and Josh Carpenter and the team. Casey Yee is still at Mozilla, but Josh Carpenter went to Google and he's working on Web VR there. Both of those guys were originally at Mozilla and they were on the team that founded WebVR. So big stuff happening there. They're developing a technology called A-Frame, which is open source. Anybody can build a WebVR experience today. All you need is a laptop and a basic understanding of like HTML and maybe a little bit of JavaScript, and you can build the type of thing that I built. So Mozilla is doing amazing things, as always, for the community there. Everything is open source and free, and they're developing some incredible stuff. Samsung, of course, we're all aware that they're creating consumer VR and cameras and processors that are going to be critical for this stuff. Classically, they've powered a bunch of devices that don't even have their brand on them. So big stuff happening there. Sony is doing consumer VR with PlayStation VR, which is already available, but they're actually planning more there. There's a company called NextVR, which is basically a startup, but they're focused entirely on experimentation with VR use cases. So if you want to see more about, like, not necessarily the hardware, but what can be done with UX and design for VR, NextVR is a good company to check out. i8 is a startup that I'm really intrigued by. They are working on holograms and volumetric VR. So if you've ever done like a 360 camera experience, maybe you watched the Olympics in VR, or you've watched like an NBA game in VR, it's basically a little 360 camera that they set in a really good location, and you can sit in that space and look around. Being able to sit stationary in a single space and move your head, but pitch, yaw, and roll, basically, that's 3 degrees of freedom. And that's what our 360 camera and like these live action VR experiences are for the most part. If you want 6 degrees of freedom, then what that's going to do is allow you the ability to move on the X, Y, and Z axis. Move forward, backward, up, down, left, and right. Like you can physically walk around in the space. And that's what I was talking about earlier. Like that's what the HTC Vive can do. That type of experience is not available at like a live event or like the Olympics or the NBA or something like that. It's not possible with a 360 camera. So you can watch the basketball game, but you can't walk around on the court as the live sport is happening, right?
Oh, wow.
i8 is working on volumetric VR, which in probably like 10 years from now is going to be possible with the dawn of quantum computing, which basically would mean that you will be able to not just have 3 degrees of freedom for a live event, but you'll be able to have 6 degrees of freedom. So you'll be able to attend the basketball game and look around, but also walk around on the court as it's happening in VR.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so big company to watch. I really cannot go without mentioning NVIDIA. They are leading all of the graphics processing for the computers and headsets that run VR and AR. Yeah, they know what they're doing. So yeah, I would watch. I think that those are the companies to be paying attention to. If you want to see what, the direction of the industry is going to be, that's, I would say, follow those companies and people that are working at those companies. If you want to get involved in this stuff and like turn this into a career, those are the big dogs, the ones that I would be looking to.
Wow. So much to just let marinate and sink in here. And again, like I said at the beginning of this episode, Austin, I'm really glad this is being recorded, because it's going to be, I have a feeling this one's going to be played multiple times. So Defenders, if you've waded through these deep waters this far, and I have a feeling you have, because this is super interesting stuff, and this really is the future. As I asked Austin in his User Defenders episode, what is the future of UX design? He called this a year plus ago. And so this is definitely important stuff to be aware of. Even if you don't happen to dive in immediately, it's still something to have at the back of your mind to kind of start even planning toward how do we start experimenting with this stuff. So it's indeed a robust subject matter to tackle. And I don't blame you if your head's spinning. You're not alone. Mine is too, but it's in a good way. I'm stimulated. My brain is super stimulated right now. So I just really wanted to do this episode with Austin to address the huge huge elephant in the room known as mixed reality. It's looming over all of us as UX designers. I mean, we're still largely focused, and rightly so, on just keeping up with designing for the context of our countless glowing rectangles already in front of us. So I'm just so delighted and glad to have a glad scientist like Austin here to shed light. He's got such a tight grip on this stuff, and he's thankfully opening his hands to let us all in on this world. And the question now, and we could certainly end the episode right here, but then I think you defenders, you'd be like, well, what do we do now? What do we do with this? So that's why that's what this part's for. I think that all of us are asking, okay, so now we have a big understanding, a much greater understanding than we ever did, thanks to Austin, of all of these nascent emerging technologies. Now, how do we start using them? What do we do? Austin, take it away.
All right. So if you want to get started with this stuff, I think on the most basic level, what you ought to do is buy a Google Cardboard, just like you did, Jason.
Yes.
And throw your smartphone in there, start playing around with it, do the tutorials, watch some YouTube videos in 360, play around with some web VR experiences, just to give yourself a little taste of the possibilities. And then if you want to start designing and developing for VR, I think the easiest place to start is with web VR. And web VR is really probably more accurately labeled web XR because it now has augmented reality capabilities thanks to tools like AR.js, which my friend Jerome in Ireland is developing right now, open source as well. But you can start with web VR by just setting yourself up with a server like you would for a normal website, and you're going to be creating something that is hosted on the internet, accessible by anything, like I said, from a laptop to a smartphone to a full-blown VR device. And then go to aframe.io, get the boilerplate from there, put that on your server, start playing around with it, and you'll see that Aframe uses an entity component system, so it looks a lot like HTML, even though it isn't. It looks and feels like HTML, so you'll feel very comfortable there. Throw a little bit of JavaScript in there, and you can start creating 3D interactive experiences on the web. If you really want to get into like 3D modeling and stuff like that, you can use tools like Magicka Voxel. It's free, or Cinema 4D. I'll send some links to Jason that he can share with you all. But really, best place to start is with a simple Google Cardboard and an implementation of web VR online, or even locally if you don't want to set up a server or anything like that. Play around with it, see what's possible, get a 3D program if you really wanted to dive into this stuff, and do some 3D modeling and see how that opens up your world. And then when you want to go big, get something like Unity for your physics rigging, and then get an HTC Vive and really see what's coming and what's possible, and do yourself a favor and show this to as many people as you possibly can, because this is going to be the world that we'll be living in. And I'll tell you, it's been a real awesome experience for me, like being here in Brazil and the different places that I've taken the HTC Vive. A lot of the time, you know, I'm like the only person within a very, very large distance that has one of those things. So being able to show it to somebody and give them that experience and see like that click happen where they're like, whoa, oh my God, my whole life just changed. It's a cool thing to witness. So that's where I would start.
This is so awesome. Defenders, keep up with Austin. Follow his work, keep tabs, because he's just in the trenches on this stuff, as you have obviously learned throughout this time that we've had together discussing this topic. And so Austin, what's the best way for our defenders to connect and to keep up with you?
Yep. So you can find a bunch of resources. You can find the VR site that I created and everything like that at austinknight.com. And that's where I put whenever I write an essay about this stuff or podcasts. I host the UX and Growth podcast, so we put a bunch of stuff about VR on there. That's going to be the place to find it. You can subscribe to my email list and everything. And then for more regular updates, things, news, thoughts, little experiments that I'm working on, it's best to follow me on Twitter at U-S-T-I-N-K-N-I-G-H-T. So Jason and I are always throwing around stuff on there. You'll probably
That's true.
See our musings.
So. Exactly. Yes, absolutely. So I want to just close with a couple of quotes from, as I mentioned, Chris Milk, filmmaker doing TED Talks and stuff. I want to close with a couple of quotes right now. He said, "In all other mediums, your consciousness interprets the medium. In VR, your consciousness is the medium." He also says, "VR connects humans to other humans in a profound way that I've never seen before in any other form of media, and it can change people's perception of each other. And that's how I think that virtual reality has the potential to actually change the world." Austin, thanks so much for being here. Thanks for this time. Thanks for letting us into this world and sharing so much value and giving us so much to think about. I'm thankful for you, and I want to say, fight on, my friend.
Thank you, Jason. It's been excellent.
Mind blown, right? There's so much to take in and let marinate in this conversation, and I'm super appreciative of Austin doing this and agreeing to spend 2 hours with me discussing this very interesting and fascinating topic. I hope you found value in it, Defenders. If you did, don't keep it to yourself. Tweet those takeaways and mention at User Defenders. I'd love to engage with you, and it really helps also other designers discover this content. Getting started, Austin had some great advice, but I also want to put this URL out there that I learned about when I was on the Thunder Nerds podcast recently. The host, Frederick, put this out there. It's uxofvr.com. There's a ton of resources, videos, ways to get started, and it seems like it's constantly being added to, and maybe this will even be on there. That'd be fun. And also, if you want to access the landing page for these episodes, it's userdefenders.com/mixedreality. I want to thank Chris Combs for the extraordinary editing, as always. I really appreciate Chris. He cranked both of these episodes out really quickly in between our normal schedule, and so I just appreciate him. That's about it. If you want to get on the biweekly bugle, you can do that at userdefenders.com/join. And that is all, I promise. Until next time, fight on, my friends.